Well, would you thank again our fantastic musicians, Alana and RJ. They have CDs, but they don't have any here, so berate them later if you'd like to hear more. Great to see you here for the second hour of our This Is Life event today with musical accompaniment. We are asking the big question today of whether the resurrection of Jesus actually makes any difference to our lives and our eternal destiny. So it's great that you could join us. My name's Hugh. I'm a fourth-year history student and the president of the Evangelical Union. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you here as part of our This Is Life campaign over these 3 weeks. This Is Life is a three-week campaign asking the big questions of life, death, the universe and everything in between, and what Jesus has to say about the big questions. It's being run by the Evangelical Union, which is a group of about 700 Christian students on campus who exist to find out more about the God of this world as revealed in the Christian Bible. So really glad you could join us today. We hope you grab a few snags over the course of the meeting. Don't feel weird about jumping up, bailing on your friends, grabbing a snag and sitting down again. We'd love you to stay around for the next hour. We will be having a couple of talks and also some question time. So if you've got questions, do hang on to them. There's going to be a mic roving around to answer those questions very shortly. If you've just grabbed a snag, please do come grab a seat. And I'm going to introduce our first speaker today, who is Murray Smith. Thanks, Murray.
G'day, Hugh.
Murray, you spoke in the last hour about Jesus and the good bits. Today you're going to be speaking about Jesus and the ugly bits, how we make sense of the not-so-good things in life from the perspective of Jesus. One question before you begin. You studied arts here at Sydney.
I did.
And now you're doing a PhD at Macquarie University. Does Macquarie have a carillon and bells?
Well, no. That's you know, the major distinguishing feature of the university would be the carillon, and it's missing. So, you know, what can you say?
Outrageous, outrageous. Good to have you back, Murray. I look forward to hearing what you have to say about Jesus and the ugly bits. Thanks.
Thanks, you. Let me start by saying again that congratulations to the EU for hosting this fantastic event. If university is about anything, then it's got to be about finding answers to the big questions in life. You know, sure, you're here to get a degree that may help in your future vocation, your future career. But really, what these few years are about is finding answers to the big questions in life. And so to put on a whole three-week extravaganza, to give people the opportunity to explore what life is all about and what Jesus has to say about the meaning of life and its purpose, it's just a fantastic thing to do. So well done, EU. It's a privilege to be here for me. I have very fond memories of this place and of this time in my life, and it's great to be here with you today. If you're here exploring the big questions, then I really hope with the EU that you will find this helpful. In the last hour, I spoke about Jesus and the good stuff in life. And I said that Jesus helps us to make sense of the good things that we enjoy in life. But if we stop there, we'd only be talking about half the picture. Because we all know that life is full of really good stuff, but you don't have to live very long before you realize that there are plenty of ugly bits in life as well. I'm sure you know the kind of stuff I'm talking about. I had first-hand experience of an ugly bit in life several years ago when I was on a humanitarian mission in the Philippines. And it was, to be frank, a wake-up call for me. We were delivering aid on the northern island of Luzon to an area that had been affected by the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, to people whose houses had been devastated and whose livelihoods had been taken away. And we're up there administering some humanitarian relief. And 3 o'clock one morning, I woke up with a massive pain in my stomach. And I tried to ignore it for half an hour or so until it just wouldn't go away. And they stuck me in a jeepney, and we rode for an hour down the roads, the bumpy roads, to the closest hospital. And they diagnosed me when I arrived at the hospital with appendicitis. It wasn't good. There were feral cats mating in the corridors in this hospital. There were cockroaches everywhere. The sewage system wasn't connected. And I thought, this is where I'm going to have the operation on my appendix. I got into the operating theatre, and it turned out they didn't have a scalpel. They didn't have suture material to tie me back up with. They didn't have anaesthetic to put me to sleep. And there I was, and the members of my team had to go across the road and buy all the medical supplies for this operation. It was a scary time. It was a wake-up call. I realised what a privilege it is to live in the place where we live with RPA just down the road, with all sorts of wonderful provisions for our health and for our safety and for our livelihood. I survived, obviously. I've got a good scar to tell the story with. But what really made me pushed home to me the reality of suffering and the ugly bits in life in this world was what happened to the guy who was next to me in the operating room. He was a four-year-old boy. He came into the hospital sick and dying. His parents couldn't afford the supplies that my team could supply for me, and ended up dying there in the operating room next to me. And that's not just ugly, that's devastating. And you don't need me to tell you that that's not a one-off event in the world. You only need to look at the news and realize that there are tsunamis that wipe out millions. There are bushfires that kill hundreds. There are cancers that claim the lives of people we love. There are relationships that break down. And you realize that, sure, life is full of good stuff. And on a day like today, it's very easy to forget about the ugly bits where we're sitting out here in the sun. But you don't have to live very long before you realize that there are plenty of ugly bits in life as well. And I want to say that just as Jesus makes sense of the good stuff in life, he also makes sense of the ugly bits. What I got to say next is perhaps a bit like going to the doctor. You know, you go to the doctor or the dentist perhaps, and the dentist will tell you that you go to the dentist with a toothache, and the dentist will tell you that actually you need root canal therapy. Or you go to the doctor with a sore chest, and actually the doctor will tell you that you need some heart surgery. The next thing I've got to say in the next few minutes might be a bit like that, because we experience the ugly bits in life at a surface level, and we see them all around us. But as soon as we open up the scriptures, the Christian Bible, and see what Jesus has to say about them, we realize that the problem goes much deeper than we thought. Listen to what Jesus had to say about the ugly bits in life. I'm reading from the Gospel of Mark. This is one of the biographies of Jesus that we have in the Bible, one of four biographies of Jesus' life, where he says this: "It's from within, out of people's hearts, that evil thoughts and sexual immorality and theft and murder and adultery and greed and evil actions and deceit and stinginess and blasphemy and pride and foolishness come. All of these things come from within, and they are what defile us." That's a hard word, isn't it? Especially as we're sitting out here in the sun and we're enjoying the good stuff of life, enjoying the barbecue. The ugly bits in life are not just out there, Jesus says. They're also in here. They're also in my life, in your life. Jesus says that our hearts are full of not only these things, but certainly these things, full of greed and jealousy and bitterness, which spills over into our actions. And I'm sure you've seen this in yourself. In those moments late at night when you're honest with yourself, you realize that you're not part of the solution to the world's problems, but actually, in reality, part of the problem itself. The heart of the problem, Jesus says, the heart of the problem with the world is not things out there, though they are real problems. The heart of the problem with the world, Jesus says, is the problem with our hearts. It's because we're made for God, and yet each of us, all of us, in our own way and at different times and in different ways, have turned our backs on God and we've said, "No thanks, God. I don't want to live with you. I don't want to live your way." And in doing that, we've dehumanized ourselves. We've cut ourselves off from the source of life. And we've brought ourselves under God's right condemnation of us. The heart of the problem with the world, Jesus says, is not out there. The heart of the problem with the world is the problem with the human heart. The problem with our hearts. The problem with my heart and with your heart. These are hard truths to hear, and I warned you, it's kind of like going to the doctor. You've got to hear the accurate diagnosis before you can hear the problem. So I want to encourage you, there is good news coming. But before we can understand what Jesus says about what God is doing, what God has done and what God is doing to fix up the problems with the world, to heal us and the problem with our hearts, we need to understand the depth of the problem. And so elsewhere, Jesus says other startling things, like everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. Sin is Jesus' word for these destructive habits of life and behavior, which cut us off from God and disrupt our relationships with each other. And he says anyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. He's saying we're both guilty for our actions and stuck. Again, it's a hard word to hear, but it makes sense of our experience, doesn't it? We're guilty because we make choices. When we're honest with ourselves, we'll realize we make choices. Choices which hurt people we love. Choices which are selfish. And as we make those choices, we become stuck in those habits of living that way. And so Jesus says, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. We're both responsible for our actions and stuck in the rut of living that way. And if that sounds like a drastic diagnosis, I think you've got to say it is. This is not an easy word to hear. But part of what has always attracted me to the Christian message, part of what has always attracted me to what Jesus has to say about life in the world, is that he faces the stark realities of life head on. Buddhism tells us that evil and suffering are just an illusion. That the problems that we see around the world and the problems that we see in ourselves are not real, but an illusion. Islam will tell us that the evil and the suffering in the world are due to the direct action of God. The Christian faith is unique, following Jesus, in facing the fact that evil and suffering in the world are real, and also that we're responsible for them. That we are responsible for the state of our lives and for the state of the world in which we live. Jesus says very clearly, the heart of the problem with the world is not out there. The heart of the problem with the world is here. It's a problem with the human heart. It's we who have led the world into ruin. Well, the Christian faith is unique in facing that stark reality. It's also unique in holding out a radical solution. Because Jesus' life and death and resurrection, which are at the heart of the Christian faith, also offer us a solution to the problem of evil in the world, the problem of our own hearts. If Jesus' life and death and resurrection show us anything, they show us that God is with us in the mess. You may not have thought a lot about Jesus, the shape of Jesus' life before, but as soon as you open up one of the Gospels, one of the four biographies of Jesus' life in the Bible, you see that his life was anything but easy. He was born under the stigma of illegitimacy. His mother was accused wrongly of having an affair with another man, of being unfaithful to her fiancé. Before he was born, he had a price on his head. King Herod the Great wanted him dead. As an infant, he became a refugee. He left his native Palestine with his family and went to Egypt. As he grew up and began to teach, he was ridiculed and rejected by the religious authorities and the political establishment. He suffered an unjust trial, and he was executed in the most humiliating and degrading and shameful way imaginable, being stripped naked and strung up to die on a Roman cross. What's remarkable about all of that is that the very earliest Christian texts we've got from the first century, the very earliest Christian texts we've got speak of Jesus as the Son of God. They speak of Jesus in that way because he spoke of himself in that way. And what they're saying is that the Son of God suffered and died. The Son of God is not distant and uninterested and remote and removed from the suffering and the heartache and the difficulties and diseases and the weakness that we experience in life in this world. No, in the person of Jesus, God came and lived among us. God came and suffered and got sick. God came in the person of Jesus and died. God is not distant from the difficulties in the world. God has seen them and experienced them firsthand. But there's more to say as well, because the heart of what was happening when Jesus died on the cross was not just that God was entering into our suffering. There's more than that. The heart of what was happening when Jesus died on the cross was that God, in the person of Jesus, was taking on himself the responsibility, the moral responsibility for the things that we have chosen to do wrong. You see that in Jesus' final words spoken from the cross. Again, I'm reading from Mark's Gospel, where it says, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, in his native Aramaic, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? What's going on there? Why is Jesus crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's because on the cross, Jesus was taking responsibility for our moral failure. Though he was innocent, he stood condemned. He was taking responsibility for the failure of the rest of us. He suffered in his body the consequences of our rejection of God. God condemned his own son in our place. And so what we're seeing there when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Is God the Father turning his back on Jesus, his son. Why? Because of our sin, because of our rejection of God, because each of us in our own way have chosen to live without him for ourselves. Why would God do that? Well, the answer is as simple as it is profound. And you can give it in one word. It's love. God so loved the world that he gave his only son, Jesus, so that whoever believes in him will not perish but have eternal life. That's the good news that comes as a response to the ugly bits in life. There's more to say, of course, heaps more to say, and it's mostly tied up with the resurrection because God is not finished with his world yet. And yet, in Jesus' death on the cross, God has dealt with the problem, the heart of the problem with the world, which is the problem with our hearts. Because Jesus has been condemned in our place, we can be forgiven. We can have our slate wiped clean. We can start afresh with God and live life with him the way it was always meant to be lived. And if that's not good news, I don't know what is. So if you're someone here today who recognizes that you're part of the problem with the world rather than part of the solution, that there's a problem in the world and part of it is the problem with your heart, then you need to hear that when Jesus died on the cross, he died there in your place. He died there so that you can be forgiven. He died there so that you can have your slate wiped clean so that you can start afresh with God. And I want to encourage you, if that's you, make sure you do business with God about it. Make sure you open up to him and speak to him about the problems in your life and thank him for what he's done in Jesus, and especially in Jesus' death on the cross, so that you can be forgiven, so that you can start life again, afresh, anew with him. And if you come along today and this is new news for you and you want to explore it further, then make sure you don't leave today without chatting to somebody in a This Is Life shirt and asking them to talk to you about further, or I'll hang around at the end. I'd love to chat to you further about this. Because if you're somebody who realizes that you have been living out of step with God and yet that God has done everything necessary for your forgiveness in Jesus, then today would be a great day to do something about that and do business with God.
Thank you, Murray. If we just echo Murray's words, if you'd like to chat to someone or find out more about these massive claims that Jesus makes, can I encourage you at the end of our time together to check out the resource table. It's the red table on the path just behind you. There's some great free resources we'd love to give you. We've got heaps of Bibles. Christians are promiscuous with the Bible. We'll give you 5 copies if you want. Lots of great books there and people to chat to. So if you want to take these questions further, that's a great way to do so. The other great way is to fill in the little slip you received on your way in and pop it in one of the people floating around with green buckets. Pop it in their buckets and we'll get in touch with you in the next few days to help you answer some of these questions and chat more about Jesus and his claims about life and death. I'm now going to introduce Krish Kandai. If you were here for the last hour, Krish spoke about the resurrection and whether it makes any difference at all. Krish, now you studied at some university in Britain, but you have worked for a while at Oxford University.
That's right.
Now, while you were working at Oxford University, I'm correct in saying that you were pining for the Carillion and the Quad in the Southern Hemisphere.
Sure. I think this is the original and Oxford is the copy, right?
Right. Yeah. So this is a great day of realization for you. But Krish, you're all over here from the UK. You work to let people know more about Jesus in the UK. And today you're going to be speaking to us about the resurrection and the implications for the resurrection for other faiths. So thanks very much, Krish.
Thank you. Hey, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Krish, which is short for Krishna, because my father is a Hindu. He's not a particularly devout Hindu because he eats beef and wears leather jackets, but culturally and historically, his family have always been Hindu. My mother, she was a Catholic, And she married my dad and got into a lot of trouble with her family for marrying across cultural and religious lines. And as a result of that, when I was born, I wasn't inducted into any one of the faiths. I wasn't baptized as a baby. I wasn't dedicated at the temple. My parents were incredibly forward-thinking, and they allowed me to choose for myself. The problem is, how do you possibly choose which faith to follow? I love my mum, I love my dad, and I didn't want to let either of them down. So how do you decide which faith to go for? Do you just pick one that kind of suits you the best, the one that you like? That's a kind of Madonna way of choosing faith, one that helps you to have better sex or whatever. How do you choose which faith to follow? For me, I had to follow, I guess, two organs. One was my mind and the other was my heart. As I read the stories of Jesus, I was attracted to him as a person. I thought, here is someone I want to follow. Here's someone worth living for. But that wasn't enough. And the thing that really convinced me was my mind. And my mind said, actually, that the evidence stacks up. And for me, the key factor was the resurrection of Jesus that we've been talking about all this week. And I want to explore this subject. What does it look like that the resurrection took place? How does that help us with the whole question about what about different faiths? Aren't all the faiths different roads to the same God? And to explore that, I want to look at three different myths about interreligious dialogue or religious belief. And then I want to throw it open for some questions from you. So the first myth is that all religions are basically the same. I don't know if you've heard people say that to you, but if you think about just that statement for a minute, it just shows that people who make that statement have actually never actually studied any of the faiths. Even if you ask a really simple question like, what is God like? You're going to get a range of different answers. And if you're someone here who has a faith and, you know, you might be a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu, if I make a statement about your faith that isn't accurate, I really want you to pick me up about it afterwards so I can be more accurate next time. But let's ask a question. What is God like? Well, for my father's family, the Hindu family, God is everything. There is no distinction between the universe and God. It's a view of God that's called pantheism. And basically, God has no moral attributes. He is both good and evil because there is no distinction between him and the universe. It's a very interesting concept. And actually, even to talk about God in personal terms is probably not that helpful because God is higher or transcendent or different from human life. So he doesn't necessarily have personality. Second view, what about a Muslim view of God? Well, a Muslim would say, well, I'm sorry, Hinduism, you know, we respect you, but we have a very different view. As Muslims believe, God is the creator of the universe. He made the universe. He's not the same as the universe. And God has created the universe with purpose, with destiny, and yet we can't really know God very well because all our language about God will fail because God is basically different, holy. What about the Christian view of God? Well, you might have seen Christians go to church and cross themselves, and Christians believe that God is one, but he is three. He is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We believe in Trinity. It's why relationships are so important to us because human beings are made in the image of God and God is a community. He is a family. He's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And the Jesus himself, when he was living on the earth, he is God in human form. And God was truly human in Jesus, but he was actually a divine being at the same time. And the resurrection is the way that Christians know that to be true. So even a really simple question, what is God like, gets you a whole set of different answers from just three faiths. Let's ask another simple question. How does someone get right with God? Because we've heard from Murray about all the things that are wrong with the world, and there is a sense of God being distant. So how do we get close to God? How do we get relationship with God? Well, in my father's faith of Hinduism, basically what you're seeking to do is to escape the cosmic circle of reincarnation. And you do that by living a life that deals with all the sins that you've committed in a previous life. what you're looking is to cancel your karmic debt. And bad things that happen to you in this life are punishments for things that you've done in a previous life. The England football coach a few years ago, Glenn Hoddle, argued that disabled people, people with physical or mental handicaps, deserve them because they're being punished for sins they've done in a previous life. And there are many Hindus that would hold to that view that of karmic retribution. So if you can live the good enough life, you can escape being born again and you can escape having to pay for your karmic debt in the past. But you can do it. For a Muslim, many Muslims believe that there are basically two recording angels, one on your right hand, one on your left hand. And at the end of the day, one of the angels has been recording all the good stuff you've been doing, and the other angel's been recording all the bad stuff you've been doing. And at the end of the day, on Judgment Day, if the angel who's been recording all the bad stuff has got the longer list, then you're destined for hell. But if the angel that's got all the good stuff has got a longer list, well, you're destined for eternal life with God. And there are a few shortcuts about how you can cancel some of those sins. If you go to a pilgrimage and throw some stones at a certain monument, all your sins up until that moment can be forgiven. Christians believe, as you've probably seen around many Christians' neck, that the cross of Jesus is the way that people can be put right with God. That none of us, by our own good deeds, is ever going to be worthy of a relationship with God. But God lets his Son come into the world to die for the sins of the world and to be resurrected to prove that his death has worked. And anyone that trusts in Jesus, wherever they come from, whatever their background, will be saved. So it's a really simple question. What is God like and how does one get right with him? And I think that neutralizes the myth that basically all religions are the same. Ask anyone from a faith what their faith is about, and I think you'll come across a range of different opinions. Second myth is, okay, all religions are different, but they are different roads to the same place. And some people have this image of a mountain, maybe a square mountain, you know, almost like a pyramid. And what you've got is the Muslim working their way up to God, following the ways of Muhammad and the Quran and the Hadiths, and they're going to get to God through their roots of Islam. But around the corner to them, unbeknownst to them, is the Hindu. And the Hindu is following the Hindu scriptures, the Gita and the Vedas, and they're working their way up to God through Hinduism. And round the back, unbeknownst to the Hindu or the Muslim, are the Christians. And the Christians are following Jesus and trusting what he's done for them, and that is their route to God. And on the judgment day, everyone's going to have a big shock because they're going to all end up at the same place. And they're going to say, oh, we thought we were going to be the only ones here. We've got to share eternity with the Muslims and the Hindus and the Christians. Now, that sounds a really humble view about the different faiths, doesn't it? And I want you to just pause for a minute and just think, actually, why might that view be incredibly arrogant and not humble at all? Just give you a second to think about that. Why might that view that all religions ultimately lead to the same place, why might that be actually an arrogant position rather than a position of humility? Just to pause for a minute for you to think about that, and then I'll give you what I think on that one. One really good question to ask people who have that view is a really simple question. It is, how do you know? How do you know that all religions ultimately lead to God? If you talk to a Muslim, they are very clear that God is Allah and Muhammad is his prophet, and that is the way to be with God. So what the person that's saying, you know, it's just another route, they're saying, actually, I know a truth about Islam that even Muslims don't know. How could they possibly know that? The only way would be if they're not climbing the mountain, but they've got some kind of spiritual helicopter that gives them a view that no one else has got. Now, where do they get that from? Have they got some kind of secret access to God that no one else has got? So it's a really important question to ask someone that says, yeah, all roads ultimately lead to God. Ask them how they know and where their information comes from. And if they ultimately say, it's just a hunch I've got, well, that's quite a big leap. In fact, I would say that's a blind leap of faith. And the Christian faith is arguing you don't need to make a blind leap of faith to believe. You just need to follow the trail of the evidence so that you can know the truth about God. Third myth I want to talk about. So some people say all religions are the same. I say do some research and talk to people from different faiths. You'll find they're not. Second, people say all roads lead to the same place. I say, how do you know? Where does your information come from? The third one, this is quite an important one. People say, you know what? It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you are sincere. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you are sincere. It's a very popular opinion, and I wish I could believe it. But I think truth doesn't actually work that way. Someone said to me earlier, aren't you arrogant for saying that Christianity is the truth? Let me give you an example. I have five children. Three of them we kind of birthed biologically, and two of them we picked up from a super... No, two of them, one of them we adopted and the other one we foster. And we love being family. It's great. Love all our kids. It's just the same. But imagine that I've asked you to be a babysitter for the weekend. And you've been really kind and you've agreed to be the babysitter for the weekend. And my wife and I are having a well-deserved night out on the town and going to a nice restaurant, eating some food. I had Vietnamese food yesterday. It's amazing. I've never had that before. That was great. I've decided to take my wife out for Vietnamese food. And while we are out, you walk upstairs just to check the kids are okay. And as you walk into our bathroom, you notice that my youngest daughter, who's four, has managed to build in the bathroom a kind of structure made out of chairs and bits of soap and bottles and stuff. And she's reached the medicine cupboard. And she's opened the medicine cupboard and she's taken out a bottle. And somehow in England we've got these childproof locks for these medicines. And somehow I can never open these bottles, but my four-year-old daughter has opened the bottle. And she's poured out a bunch of these tablets that say paracetamol, and she's got them in her hand. Now, can I just ask you for a favour here? Hands up if you would stop my daughter from eating a handful of paracetamol. Hands up if you do that. How dare you impose your beliefs onto my daughter? Are you saying my daughter is not sincere in her belief that those paracetamol are actually sweets? You are imposing imperialistically your hegemonic views on my daughter. Seriously, are any of you free on Saturday night? Because I do need a babysitter, and you have passed the test. You're doing the right thing. If you stop my daughter, you believe in something called absolute truth, objective truth. Truth that is mind independent. Truth that is independent of sincerity. In fact, if you've ever sat an exam at Sydney University, you know that truth doesn't work on sincerity. If they ask you, you know, what is the capital of England? And you say, I sincerely believe that it is Katoomba. You don't get a mark for sincerity. So, it doesn't work that truth is whatever you believe sincerely. It doesn't work anywhere. So why do we think it's different with God? Why do we think there's a different epistemology when we're dealing with God? So those are the three myths I just wanted to explain to you. Now, how does the resurrection help us? Christians believe that Jesus came into the world. In fact, if you've got a Bible at home, there's an amazing passage in John chapter 14. It's a few hours before Jesus is going to the cross. And what happens is, he's there with his disciples. He knows he's going to be killed. And the first thing he says to his disciples is, guys, don't worry. I've got your back. Don't be anxious about anything. I'm going away to my father's house, and there's plenty of room there. I'm going to prepare a place for you there. Now, just think about that for a moment. Jesus is about to be killed, but what he's doing is he's looking out for his mates. I said earlier, I just find Jesus such an attractive personality, because here he is at the most crucial moment in his life, and he's not worried about himself. He's thinking about his followers. That's the kind of guy that you'll be giving your life to follow. Someone who actually puts your needs ahead of their own. So then he says to the disciples, look, they say to him, where are you going? Show us where you're going. You know, show us the Father. You know, help us. We don't understand where you're going. And Jesus says to them, look, guys, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So Jesus says it really clearly and positively. I am the way, not a particular route that for those of people that like crosses and stuff. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then he says it negatively. No one gets to the Father except through me. Now, is Jesus saying that because he's incredibly arrogant? Or is he saying it because it's the truth? Essential to the Christian faith is that there was no other way that God could deal with the problems, the ugliness of life that Murray was talking about earlier. Look, I love my kids. I've got 5 kids. And imagine this. I used to live in a really dangerous part of England called Harrow. And Harrow was so dangerous that one day someone stole the garbage bin from outside of my house. I was trying to work out who would possibly steal a garbage bin from outside of my house. I decided it must have been someone with a rubbish job. Or not enough disposable income. Oh, it's a bad joke, I know. Anyway, so imagine, right, these kind of bin bandits come back to my house. But this time they don't want my garbage bin. They want all our family treasure. And they've rounded up my kids in the lounge and my wife, and they've got a knife or a gun, and they say to me, give us everything you've got or we'll hurt one of your children. Now, I love my kids. I would gladly sign over everything I own rather than have them hurt my kids. And yet God, who apparently is God the Father and loves the Son, was in a really interesting situation one night, a few verses after that moment I read to you in John 14. Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's praying so hard that blood is dripping from his head. And he prays to God, he says, God, I don't really want to go through the cross. Take this cup of suffering away from me. If there's any other way, would you take this cup of suffering away from me? Now look, God in that moment decides that Jesus needs to go through the cross, so he allows him to go through it. Now, if all God was doing was providing another variety of religion for people that didn't like Judaism or Hinduism or Islam, I'd say that was cosmic child abuse. But because there was no other way by which human beings like you and me could be put right with God, Jesus went to the cross, dying for the sins of the whole world, not just Jewish people, not just black people, not just white people, the whole world. And so for me, essential to the Christian faith is that Jesus died. It's the only way we could be put right with God. And he rose from the dead to show you, to demonstrate in reality that it was true. Now, those are controversial things. And this isn't just a kind of academic question for me, because most of my family, they live in Malaysia, and they're lovely people. I love them to bits, but they're Hindus. And we have a difference of opinion about how one can have eternal life. So this matters. If I've got this wrong, I want to know. So over to you. I want to give you the chance to ask some questions. Maybe you need a moment just to think of one and come back at me. But let's do that. And then my lovely assistant Yvette, she's a dancer. She's promised to dance for us later. Is that right? She'll come to you in a moment, but I want to give you a chance just to chat with a neighbour, come up with a question, and we'll talk again together. How long have we got? Is it a bit more open, isn't it?
Fun?
Does it need to finish it too?
Yeah, it's probably about 2 minutes. So probably about 5 minutes of questions, and then I wrap up for a minute.
Okay, fine.
It's like training with mini crowns.
Yeah, I know.
Are they? Cool.
Yeah.
It was a good song. God, I can't recognise those tunes. You guys are good. Okay, friends, the lovely Yvette over here. Give us a wave, Yvette. Give us a twirl. Got a little dance move for us? Thank you. Good job. She will run to you, or prance, if that is more helpful. If you have a question, just put your hand up, and Yvette will come to you. Have you got a question that you want to raise this afternoon? There's a lady over here. Prance. Is that a bit of prancing would be good. Thank you. She was waving at someone. Don't ever go to an auction. You probably could have bought a masterpiece for that wave. Good. Anyone else got a question they want to raise? Totally up for that.
When you were talking earlier about morality and Christianity being the best basis for absolute morality, and you had an example of, you know, someone saying, oh, this isn't fair. Well, from my understanding of biblical stories, there's a lot of things that happens, a lot of things that happen that God is responsible for that aren't fair, like directly, particularly in the Old Testament, which you then might discount, but there's things that God wants done that I would say aren't fair.
Okay.
How do you account for that?
That's a really helpful question. Let me repeat it to make sure I've understood it. So particularly in the Old Testament, there seems to be some things that God allows or God even does that we would say was not fair. And so how can we base our morality on the Bible? That is a really, really good question. I hope I don't give you too short or flippant an answer. Let's chat later if it helps you. I think the idea that God sets the ultimate moral standards is difficult for us to cope with because in the end, we will be accountable to him. And to say, God, you have not performed fairly is a bit difficult. It's a little bit like someone in prison challenging the judge that sent them to prison, saying it wasn't fair, isn't it? So we're not in a kind of equal position to be able to challenge God. But there are some really difficult bits of the Old Testament, I agree with you, and there are bits I struggle to understand. Particularly, you could talk about the idea of slavery. Slavery is not, in the Old Testament, God doesn't say slavery is wrong. God seems to permit slavery. I think the idea is that there is a progression of thought throughout the Bible. And you've got some building blocks that are the same all the way through. So the sanctity of life, that God values all human life, whether it's someone who is old or young, someone who's single or married, someone who is disabled or abled. God says every human being is made in his image. Now, it takes the people of God a long time to work out the implications of that. And in the Old Testament, they allow there to be slavery. In the New Testament, they kind of get that concept a bit more and they begin to undermine the system. And so Paul in his letters says, actually, because of Jesus, there is no longer any slave or free, Jew or Gentile, male or female. We are all equal in the eyes of God. And again, it takes the church a long time to work out the implications of that. But by the 18th century, people like William Wilberforce were saying, hold on, the Bible seems to say all life is valuable. We've got this horrific slave trade. We need to do something about it. So I think you see a trajectory through the Bible that, yeah, all life is valuable. They're permitting slavery, not saying it's a good idea, but allowing it to happen. It gets undermined theologically in the New Testament, and then the church works out the implications of that and does something about it. We were really slow, and I apologize that it took us so long. So I think sometimes we take a snapshot in the Old Testament and say, well, see, God's not behaving fairly. But I think sometimes following the larger trajectory is a more helpful perspective, maybe. That's a really helpful question. Come back to me later if you want to talk some more. Yvette, have you got another question for us? Feel free to wave at us and tell us what you think. Okay, well, please feel free to come and talk to me afterwards. And tomorrow we'll be unpacking some more of the implications of the resurrection. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks very much, Krish. As Krish said, we will be continuing the conversation each day this week, Wednesday and Thursday, 12 till 2 p.m. Tomorrow's event at 12 p.m. in the chemistry building is asking the question of whether God really wants to persuade us. And if you're wondering why the Evangelical Union is running the This Is Life campaign, that's a great talk to come along to. That's 12 o'clock in the chemistry building. And at 1 p.m., another talk about the resurrection in Eastern Avenue Auditorium. Just a few things before we wrap up. If you've got more questions from today, if today's raised some more questions for you about life, death, resurrection, and the claims of Jesus, can I encourage you to fill out the feedback form that you received at your when you got your sausage and pop it in one of the green buckets. If people with the green buckets, just wave them around. We'll get in touch with you at the EU and let you know how you can find out more answers to those questions. We'd love to meet up with you and read the Bible if that's what you'd like to do. So please do pop that form in the buckets and we'll get back to you in the next few days. We've also got a resource table at the back. Lots of great resources there. Heaps of Bibles, great books. Go and grab them. They're free. Next week, the EU is back to its regular activities. We've got Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, a talk each day at 1 p.m. Looking at the question of what it would actually look like to become a Christian. We've changed our whole program around to continue the conversation. So we'd love to see you there tomorrow and next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at 1 p.m. Thanks again very much for joining us today for our This Is Life event. Really look forward to seeing you tomorrow and we hope you do well in polishing off another 100 sausages. Thanks again. See you tomorrow.